From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, today is D.C. Emancipation Day, so Emancipation Day greetings to you.
And greetings to you, Kojo, and hello, everyone.
Joining us later in the broadcast will be Boyd Rutherford. He's the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. First, we'll also talk with Brian Simonnier, the minority leader in the Maryland State Senate. But joining us now is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a D.C. council member representing Ward 5. Council Member McDuffie, Emancipation Day greetings to you.
Happy Emancipation Day to you, Kojo, and to all your listeners and everybody out in the city.
Before we get to D.C., Tom Sherwood, there's a recall effort against a Fairfax County prosecutor, Steve Descano, who we will remember won office a year and a half ago with the promises of progressive reforms on a range of issues. Now, Stand Up Virginia says Descano has not been tough enough on offenders. And it seems to me at this point that they're attacking Descano for doing exactly what he promised to do.
Yes, and it's not clear how much weight Stand Up Virginia has. It's obviously a conservative group. It says it's going to spend time now to gather at least 30,000 legal signatures, which means they probably have to gather 60,000 to make certain they have enough to try to do a recall. I just don't quite understand why this group is deciding to do this, fighting an old battle, when right now the Republican Party in Virginia is going to have its convention on May 8th. There's a very concerted effort, to get somebody elected, nominated for governor that can compete in Northern Virginia and around the state. And it just seems like a real distraction among Virginians, conservative Virginians, who need to be more organized if they hope to blunt any of the support the Democrats have later this year. I just don't understand this decision. But again, it's a very conservative group. I'm not sure how big it is, and we'll see if they can get the ballot signatures.
Well, the D.C. statehood bill is going to the House floor next week, and there is little doubt that it will pass the House. The problem, I guess, people are seeing is in the Senate. In the meantime, it's about 22 Republican attorneys generals have opposed D.C. statehood as unconstitutional. And in a quick response led by D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine, 24 Democratic attorneys general said that the Republican attorney generals don't understand the Constitution at all. But I think the fight that we're looking at is the one likely in the Senate, correct?
Yes, and we don't know exactly where that's going to go. The House will vote on this next week, and it'll be approved. Speaker Pelosi is for it. Only 44 senators, 44 out of 100, have even publicly said they're for this bill if it gets brought up in the Senate. They would need at minimum 51 votes, maybe 60 votes for a filibuster. It's not clear President Biden and the Congress will waive the filibuster rule to let statehood be voted on with 51 votes, but I'm not even sure yet that the Democrats can muster 51 votes. And even if they do, the move by the Republican attorneys general clearly is an indication that should this bill pass Congress and be approved by President Biden, it will be taken to the courts and up to the Supreme Court. Now, it's not clear the Supreme Court will act. It's conservative, but it also has said Congress has power, for redistricting and other things. So it's not clear what would happen. But if this statehood bill passes, it's still not clear what its future will be in the court system.
Well, our guest, Kenyon McDuffie, D.C. Council member representing Ward 5, is a lawyer and a former prosecutor. So, Tom Sherwood, I'm going to steal your thunder and ask him the question that's been on our mind. And that is, Kenyon McDuffie, there's speculation that current Attorney General Carl Racine may get an offer for a post within the Biden administration. And if he accepts that post, then, of course, his position will become open. There is word on the street that one Kenyon McDuffie might be interested in running for D.C. Attorney General. Can you confirm?
That's a pretty big streak, too.
Look, I'm shocked that you actually beat Tom to the punch on this, Kozel. Now you ask that question first. Look, I've been approached by a number of different people. Some of my constituents, we've got folks in the advocacy community, even folks in the business community have been asking about me running for attorney general. Some have asked about me running for mayor. What can I say? I'm a D.C. native. I love my hometown, Tom. And I love the people, and I love serving them. So anybody, frankly, who is as privileged as I am to be elected to public office in their hometown has probably thought about what it would be like to be mayor or for people who are lawyers to be attorney general. And so I didn't go into politics, to run for the highest office necessarily. I went into politics to serve, to do what's best for district residents and to help my city, the city that raised me. And so, as with any important decision that I make, in life, it's a decision that I would discuss with my wife, my daughters, and my Ward 5 family before I make any decisions. But you will be one of the first five people to know, Kozel.
Tom, sure.
Let me follow this up. You'll acknowledge that you are having conversations about possibly entering the race if Attorney General Racine leaves early to take a position in the Biden administration. He has said, Mr. Racine has said in a public speech, that two terms are enough as attorney general. Let somebody else do it. That's a direct quote. So just, without all the other filibuster, can you acknowledge you are having those conversations about whether you will do it? And then I have a follow-up.
So
that'd
so
be a yes or a no.
I appreciate as a former prosecutor, you want to have a yes or no answer, Tom, but I'm going to answer like this. I have been approached by people who've asked me about it, and there were conversations of which I broached, but, there have been people who've been asking me about that specifically, but other offices as well.
Okay, but a conversation has to be a two-way street. You're not sitting there not responding, so you are having this conversation. Let me ask a tougher question. A tougher question. If Attorney General Racine were to leave early and the office opens up for a special election, and if you decide to run for Attorney General, these are all ifs, I recognize that. I know that there also been talk in Ward 5 that former council member Harry Thomas Jr., who went to prison for stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars intended for youth programs, is also talking about trying to win the Ward 5 seat back. If he should be a candidate, whatever happens with you, but if Harry Thomas were to be a candidate for the Ward 5 seat under any circumstance, would you support him?
So, look, I love a good reporter like yourself loves a good hypothetical, Tom. The reality is those things aren't happening right now. Let me tell you what is happening.
Conversations
right now.
Are.
Let me tell you what's happening right now. We're in a global pandemic that's killed more than 1,000 D.C. residents, and we've got a homicide epidemic in our city that's killed 55 people already, and the homicide rate is up 31% today over where it was last year. So when you talk about those dual crises that are facing our city, those are the things that are pressing in the communities when I'm at Costco or when I'm, at my local restaurant where people walk up to me. They're asking about those things. They're talking about
the answer to the question is clearly that we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So I got to move on.
Okay, but just be clear, this is the politics hour, and it's not out of line to ask the question about whether you're looking at this. And the answer is Tom, you are.
Tom, it certainly is not out of line. And I'm not trying to play coy, Tom. Listen, what I did say is I love my city, and this city has helped raise me. I love to serve, and I have thought about it. I have thought about it. Sure.
We'll cross the Tommy Thomas Bridge when we come to it. I wanted to start by having you weigh in on some recent political hardball. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser canceled her weekly calls with the D.C. Council. In response, Council Chairman Phil Mendelson says he's going to start requiring D.C.'s top health and emergency management officials to attend weekly 90-minute hearings with the council. What is going on between the mayor and the council?
Listen, to cancel the weekly COVID-19 meetings is plainly a mistake. I don't think that the mayor should have did it. And I think that the idea that a government, any government for that matter, that is trying to get through a pandemic and into recovery should be enhancing communication between the two branches and not lessening it. And I think it was a mistake to cancel those meetings, and I'm supportive of holding weekly hearings in order to be able to get the information that council members have been asking about and to hear what the plans are to work towards recovery. The mayor has her press conferences that she has. On the other hand, council members ask questions and amplify the voices of our constituents, and our constituents deserve more transparency during this pandemic. As I mentioned, it has killed more than 1,000 people, not less.
Did you find the meetings with the mayor useful, and why do you think she called them off?
Yeah, I found them useful. I found them useful to gather information, to hear what their strategy were, how they were deploying new initiatives. Did they get a bit, testy at times? Sure they did. But I think it's just the give and take of government where you've got two separate yet equal branches. And I think, again, there's been a lot of talk about what cities are doing to get through the pandemic and states are doing. And you need collaboration. You need to be together. Even people have said, we're going to get through this together. Well, canceling this type of meeting when it's this important, when the stakes are this high, is not collaboration. And I think we need to change that. And I'd like for her to reinstate those weekly calls.
Tom Sherwood.
Just a quick follow-up. Chairman Mendelson has said that the mayor abruptly canceled these meetings without discussing maybe a compromise about limiting what could be brought up. The mayor's office has said the meetings trail off into unrelated subjects about COVID, and it gets kind of long and testy, as you just said. But it seems to me the mayor could have discussed this with Mendelson and worked out a deal on how you would discuss the COVID thing and not let it be such a free-form meeting. Would you be open to some kind of compromise?
I am certainly open to any sort of compromise that allows the mayor and the council to be on the same page, because I think we do have a shared goal, which is to keep our residents healthy and to address the horrible consequences thus far of the pandemic, both the physical and mental health of our residents, but as well the economic health of our city. We need to revive our economy and work towards recovery. And I think having these calls, despite some of the challenges, is worth the compromise to reinstate them.
Our guest is D.C. Councilmember Kenyon McDuffie. He represents Ward 5. Before I go to the phones, Councilmember McDuffie, we mentioned earlier today is Emancipation Day in the district, and it's a good time as ever to talk about racial equity. In an op-ed for the Washington Post in February, you said it's time for D.C. to implement a racial equity agenda. What would that look like to you, and what steps are you taking to move such an agenda forward?
What it looks like for me, Kojo, is eliminating the district's stark racial wealth gap. We have got a city of haves and have-nots, and we need to take more intentional steps to center our governance, both through the council as well as the executive, through the lens of racial equity. We need to make our city and our economic growth more inclusive of folks who have felt left out over the last several years. And so what it looks like in practical terms is really making the investment. I've called on the mayor in my letter to her to put a study in place to look at funding a $100 million pilot for a guaranteed income program for district households where you've got people whose incomes fall below 100% of the federal poverty line. I'm talking about bold initiatives like district-based baby bonds. I think we need to be focused on those transformative policies. Frankly, over my tenure, I have been focused on when it comes to criminal justice reform, when it comes to juvenile justice reform, when it comes to racial equity. The REACH Act passed last year, and we've just stood up at the council's Office on Racial Equity, and it's going to be really important to evaluate our work as a government through the lens of racial equity. And I'm also pleased that the mayor, and give credit to her, she just hired the chief equity officer for the executive as well.
Dr. Amber Hewitt, a lot of people want to talk to you, but I'll start with a tweet which addresses an issue that a lot of our callers probably want to know about. Why does Councilmember McDuffie support the taking of the people's land, McMillan Park, and gifting it to a developer group? That was a tweet from Carol.
I don't agree with the characterization that it's a taking. It's actually land that the District of Columbia owns and has owned for several decades, since the late 80s, and it sat dormant all that time. And what I've heard from residents is that they would like to see smart, community-driven economic development. And over the course of several years, you know, even before I was on the council, there was a community-driven planning process, and now there's a proposed development that the council has supported, which has been thwarted in the courts for some years as well, but they've gotten some of the roadblocks cleared, and I'm excited about it. And frankly, if you knock on doors of people who live in and around that community, you're going to hear more people than not saying they can't wait to have a park over there. They can't wait to perhaps have a grocery store in walking distance so they don't have to get in their cars. They can't wait to be able to make use of that 25 acres for all these years has not served our community.
Tom Sherwood.
I'd like to follow this up briefly with two parts. You were at the protest meeting with the Deputy Mayor for Economic Development that I attended about Ivy City in Northeast Washington. The poor, moderately working class, no-income families in that long-neglected neighborhood are urging the mayor to put $20 million in the budget to restore Crummell School as a community center. I'd ask you, if you've pressed the mayor to do that, do you see it maybe in her budget that she'll put out in May? But then on the comprehensive plan about McMillan or Ivy City or wherever else, some people are worried that the comprehensive plan that you guys are about to pass will limit the ability of citizens to go into court to fight major developments that they don't want. Will the new comprehensive plan for the whole city limit the right to sue over development projects? Two-part question.
So the first part of your question, I wholeheartedly support the residents of Ivy City and think they deserve to have a recreation center in their community. The old Crummell School has been closed for decades. It is the center of the Ivy City community, and they should not have to beg and plead the city to make the sorts of investments that they're asking for. And so I did include that as a budget priority for me in my letter to the mayor and asked that she put $20 million in the budget to create a recreation center for that community. So I am in lockstep with the residents over there. I think it is well past time. I made investments in terms of some of the streetscapes and, okay, and infrastructure for other things, but we need to do more. And so I support that. Right. On the other part, the comprehensive plan, I was the one who worked with my colleagues to introduce language in the framework to make sure that we're looking at this through the lens of racial equity. As a result of the establishment of the council's office on racial equity, there will be a racial equity impact assessment of the comprehensive plan. And so it is important for residents, particularly those who are suffering from the anxiety and stress of this pandemic, and many others who have felt like the city is not for them, they don't really see a space for them, that the comprehensive plan is a tool to think about land use now and into the future. And I think that the work that we've done as a council, particularly in Ward 5, is to look at ways to create opportunities for smart economic growth with guardrails, right? Not displacing more than 20,000 people, as has been reported in the past.
Mr. McDuffie, the question is, under the current comprehensive plan compared to the new one that the council is about to approve, will it be harder for citizens to go into court to challenge zoning decisions for planned unit developments, big development projects? Is it going to be harder under the new comp plan than it is right now?
The goal is not to make the planned unit development process more difficult or even less difficult. The goal is to focus on land use and to think about how we help to grow our city in a way that keeps people here and not displace them. And so
the answer is,
I don't agree with that characterization. Yeah, I don't agree with that. I don't think so.
So yes, it
will. That's not the point.
Here's Cammy in Ward 3. Cammy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm wondering, given Councilmember McDuffie, you know, you say that you really focus on racial equity. I'm wondering if you're regretting your vote against Councilmember Allen's tax increase on high-income residents. I mean, if we think about racial equity, that is a great way to start to move in that direction. And if that comes up again, how are you going to vote?
Well, you know what? I can tell you three more great ways to address racial equity that I think go well beyond
a tax increase. And so I think a lot of folks have their sights set on one means to generate revenue. What I'm saying is that we've got to think about ways to create economic mobility for people. And the things that I've included in my priorities for the mayor's budget, I think are much more transformative and long term. And frankly, what I plan to do as committee chair of the Committee on Business and Economic Development that has authority around tax policy is to hold a hearing on this matter so that we can hear different proposals and consider that one that you just mentioned, along with others, to be able to move forward in the city. And so,
And Santi writes on Twitter, does Councilmember McDuffie support fully funding the Vision Zero Act this budget cycle after the recent spate of four traffic fatalities, including Evelyn Troyer in Ward 5?
Yes, absolutely. Look, a cyclist recently died in a car accident, and it's just another in the latest of a slew of these types of pedestrian incidents and accidents, frankly, where people being killed. And so what I and working with my colleagues are really trying to do is to make sure that we are pushing Vision Zero and supporting that effort, but also looking at ways. And frankly, I was just out in my ward with DDOT director looking at some of the problematic intersections in Ward 5 and thinking about ways to enhance safety, both for people who are walking and others who are on their bicycles. And so, yes.
We're running out of time very quickly, and I know there's one thing both Tom and I want to ask you about. But very quickly, the D.C. Police Reform Commission released 90 recommendations for how to rethink public safety in the district. What do you think of those proposals? And overall, do you think the commission's recommendations are either too ambitious or do not go far enough? You have about a minute.
I'll keep it shorter than a minute. I'll say thanks to those folks who served on that police reform commission. I think they did a tremendous job with their work, and I support, generally speaking, the recommendations that they issued. I think are they ambitious? Sure, they are, but I also think that they're well worth considering and thinking through how we prioritize some of those recommendations and begin to try to fund and implement them.
Well, before we let you go, and Tom may want to jump in on this too, we both know that you are a longtime, very close friend of Virginia Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who is running for governor and running very low at about 4%. In large measure, it is felt because of accusations made against him by women. Those accusations have never been investigated. Justin Fairfax is obviously still very upset about that. I'm assuming that you speak with him from time to time. Where do you see this all going?
Sure. I do speak to him from time to time. Justin is a dear, dear friend. We grew up together. And I can't think about Justin without thinking about all the members of his family who I have a extremely close connection to. And so I don't know where it's going. What I know is that, he's on my list of people who I pray for because of the challenges that he's faced. And I think that ultimately the people of Virginia will decide his political fate. But Justin is a dear, dear friend of mine, and it's a tremendously challenging circumstance that he finds himself in. And everybody who's involved in that matter, obviously have had some really tough times.
Tom Sherwood.
I just want to mention the bicycle safety again. Jim, there were hundreds of people who did a ghost bike ride last night for Jim Pagels, the man who was killed in Massachusetts in 2nd Street in a wreck. Not wasn't so much an accident as a horrible wreck.
No, and I appreciate the way that you frame that. It sounds like a really horrible wreck. We had a horrible wreck, and a person was killed at the intersection of in Ward 5 at Michigan Avenue. In 10th Street, right near Brooklyn Station, not too long ago. And to look at his wife and look at his kids and look at his family have to suffer the loss, I can only imagine what they're going through. And so more needs to be done, period.
Kenyon McDuffie is a D.C. council member representing Ward 5. Councilman McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Kozo. Thank you, Tom.
Up next is Brian Simonair, the minority leader in the Maryland State Senate. I'm Kojo Nandi. Right, hope it make him stand right, hope it make him get light. Outright, I'ma say it outright, only in the Lord light. Fast.
fast lane, trying to find a last way, driving by my past pain. Last train, if I catch a last train, I'ma beat the road way. I'm stuck, maybe I'm doing too much. Oh, could have been luck, but maybe I ain't doing.
Welcome back. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, Boyd Rutherford. But joining us now is Brian Simonair, the minority leader in the Maryland State Senate. He's a Republican representing District 31 in Anne Arundel County, including Pasadena, Brooklyn Park, Lakeshore, and parts of Glen Burnie. Senator Simonair, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tom Short, before we get directly to what's going on in the Maryland Senate, let's talk about Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. She wants to invest in the FedEx Field area to make it a year-round destination. We know those of us who have gone to games at FedEx Field knows that virtually nothing else happens in that neighborhood. But we also know that there was a point at which I think Mayor Muriel Bowser was hoping to lure the Washington football team back to Washington.
Yes, in short, the plan by every mayor since Tony Williams to have the Washington football team return to a site at the RFK Stadium has gone nowhere. I'm trying to get my verbs right. The FedEx Field has been there since 1997 when Jack Kent Cook, the owner, abandoned the district for the suburbs, and it's never been adequately developed. It's hard to get to. There are horrible traffic jams on the beltway. A lot of people have to walk a long distance. It's just a underdeveloped situation for such a wealthy football team. Also, Brooks says, let's fix this. If the team is going to stay at the stadium site there now, FedEx Field, and we don't know that it is, but we think it looks like that's the only choice it has, why not put some economic development there? There's going to be sports betting at the stadium in a couple of months maybe, and why not put something there that people will come to rather than trudging to go to the football games? So it's a strong move by Ms. Alsobrooks, who apparently, as we learned recently, is not going to run for governor next year. She's going to seek a second term as county executive, and she wants this to be one of her major projects.
Mr. Minority Leader, is that something you would favor?
I think it's something interesting to look in. I'm a big football fan. I happen to like the Ravens. My dad was, which one was ever doing better, he would root for them. I think it brings a lot of excitement to the area, so hopefully that'll work well.
This was your first session as Senate Minority Leader. The General Assembly wrapped up its session Monday at midnight. Hopefully you've caught up on your sleep by now. But what was it like leading your party in a chamber where there are twice as many Democrats as Republicans? And how did you get along with Democratic leadership?
Well, it's always hard being outnumbered. It's kind of like going on a baseball field and they get 9 and you get 5 and say play ball and see how fair it is. But we just have to work that much harder. The thing you have to realize in Annapolis, we pretty much have new leadership all around. The House just elected their new leadership, I think, this week for the minority party. And also on the Democrat side, they're relatively new, 1 or 2 years in. So you've got leadership completely new in all the positions. And I think you see the growing pains with several pieces of legislation, how it was coordinated between the House and the Senate. We've also seen a huge shift to the left with the new leadership under the Democrat speaker and president. So I think you saw a shift in the Republican side as well, where we were typically more conservative, but we played the role of the moderator. Things have shifted so far left. We're trying to bring balance back to Maryland in the legislature, and that's been a full-time job.
Tom Sherwood.
Senator, thanks for being on the program. We appreciate it. Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford, who we'll speak to later in this program, made it clear that he's not going to run for governor. He was seen as one of the best potential candidates. This week, Commerce Secretary Kelly Schultz says she is running for governor. And Harford County Executive Barry Glassman, who had been considering running for governor, announced he'll run for controller since Peter Franchot is running for governor. It looks to me, unlike Virginia, It looks to me like the Republican Party is going to be better organized and more focused on which moderate conservative candidates you're going to put up in this in the state elections next year. Do you anticipate that there'll be a lot of candidates for governor, or do you think the party will rally around Kelly Schultz? Even Dirk Hare, the party chairman, has says he's not endorsing anyone, but he wants people to give money to the candidates that have announced. It looks like you guys are much more organized in Virginia.
Well, debate is good, so I hope we don't just have one candidate. I think it'll help flesh out the ideas. And I think what you're seeing in the Republican Party is that we're no longer just the party of no, but we're the party of solutions. And that's what we came in this session in Annapolis saying. We want solutions. We just don't want to try to knock down bad ideas. We were successful in some of them we weren't. So we're going to have a great team. It's already starting to form from comptroller to governor to county executives. And I think by 2022, the people are going to be fed up with the, as I say, the far lurching to the left that we see in Annapolis. I believe Maryland is more of a moderate state and they look for balance. And that's what our approach is, trying to find the balance in things. Now, I'll give you a perfect example. We just had a grueling session. It seemed like a year-long session, but it was only 3 months. But right in the middle of a pandemic, the Democrat leadership wanted to raise $250 million in new taxes right during the middle of a pandemic. We fought that. The governor vetoed it. And after hours and hours of debate, the majority party overrode it. And they raised $250 million of taxes. And I call it the pandemic tax because what they taxed were things that were helping us in the pandemic, like Netflix, e-books, e-music, things like that. And it's just, it's out of touch with Marylanders. And I think they're really fed up with that. And they want a balanced approach.
Well, tempers flared slightly on the last day of the session when Democrats voted to limit the time for debate on legislation to 40 minutes. This cut down on time for Republicans to offer amendments on a particular bill relating to the cost of landlord fees to start an eviction. The current filing fee is $8. The measure was seeking to raise it to $50. What was the nature of your disagreement about this?
Well, I mean, it was getting late in the session. We were in the 89th day of a 90-day session. We were working long hours. Sometimes we were in there until 1 a.m. in the morning. And we had solutions again. We had amendments that we wanted to help produce a better product. And the Democrat leadership shut us down with a cloture where they just say you only get a certain amount of time and then you're done no matter if you're finished giving your solutions or not. And I think that just was a culmination of being shut down many times during the session on very important issues. And the thing that's frustrating from the minority party, and let me just say up front, we get along personally, but on the issues, we have great differences. We provided really good solutions, like on the climate solutions bill and others. And it was rejected on the floor on a party line vote. And it just gets frustrating. And then it went over to the House and the House said, you know what, that's a great idea. And they put it back in the bill and sent it back over to the Senate. So I wish we could get beyond the partisanship and actually look for solutions that help people. I think that's what they sent us down to Annapolis to do. Unfortunately, it just gets too party oriented. I think that was just a build up on that last day.
You joined the Senate first in 2007. You just mentioned the partisanship and possibly getting beyond it. Do you think the legislature is becoming more partisan than when you joined it or not?
Well, it's interesting. It depends who you talk to. I saw it quoted in the paper that they said that we're not getting more partisan. It's just the minority party is more organized in their opposition. I think the truth is somewhere in between that. And I'll tell you what I think a core reason of it is, because we've prided ourselves not being Washington, D.C. style politics. But it's the redistricting maps where they're gerrymandered so bad. I mean, we're the poster child for the worst gerrymandered congressional maps in the United States. And when you do that, what you do is you basically create a district where it's the primary election is the election because it's so gerrymandered. And when you have that, that tends to cater to the extremes because they want to get elected in the primary and they don't have to worry about a general election. So on both sides, it becomes more extreme. And we, you've seen a shift in Annapolis where the moderate Democrats are getting beat. There's, you know, they're like the way of the dodo bird. They're becoming extinct. And it's becoming far more left. And we're trying to push back those proposals that they call progressive, which sometimes I just call liberal. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. There's a progressive tax bracket bill that just passed, and it was supposed to give the locals the ability to have a tax bracket system, much like the state has. But unfortunately, we read the bills, and the bill that came before us more than doubled the tax that they had to charge on the lowest rate. They incentivized the governments with gobs of money to raise the lowest minimum rate all the way to the top rate that they charge the rich. And then the lowest rate's even higher than what the state does. And then they have the audacity to say that's helping working families, because we offered amendments to help the working families. And again, all they could say is that would not be helpful, and they rejected it on party lines. So we're the party helping the working families. We don't look for fancy titles. We actually look for what's in the bill that actually would help the working families.
Tom Sherwood.
Thank you. I want to point out, on this past General Assembly session, Governor Hogan called it by far our best legislative session in 7 years, but the minority leader in the House, Nick Kipke, I think he pronounces his name, called it the worst session in 15 years. So there's some disagreements there. But Senator, you mentioned redistricting. It's underway right now in the state of Maryland. Are you worried that majority Democrats will shift boundaries to put Rep. Andy Harris, the only state Republican in the congressional delegation, out of office by gerrymandering his district?
Well, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, right now, I believe it's 7-1 Democrats, which is not a fair representation of what Maryland looks like. I was here in 2010 when Governor O'Malley made the last map, and he's come out since then and said it was purely partisan how they drew the maps. So the beauty of this year is Governor Hogan has a commission working on a nonpartisan, three Democrats, three Republicans, and three independents, and you have to have a supermajority to create the map. They're going to go throughout the state, get the people's input, and create a map that actually reflects what the people want, opposed to what a party wants. We all know right now the maps are generated for the politicians. And, you know, let me say up front, I know that happens in Republican states as well. So I'm not saying, you know, we're the only ones, but I believe you should do what is right, independent of what other states are doing. We have had legislation in for the last 3 or 4 years to put a nonpartisan commission in. The Democrats don't want it because it's going to hurt them. But again, I say, don't give me a Republican map. Don't give me a Democrat map. Give me a map that's fair for the people, and we'll be satisfied with that.
Do you support, well, speaking of being fair to the people, you're the neighbor of the District of Columbia. Do you happen to support or oppose statehood for the District of Columbia?
Yeah, I try not to get into too much of the federal politics. I did hear one option is bring some of Washington, D.C. back into Maryland. So that's an interesting option. But I'll leave that to the
federal. What's your view of that? What's your view of that, other than it's interesting? You're opposed to that.
There's several options they can do. I really haven't put time in to consider it since I have no impact on it.
Let's go into a few of the major bills that passed. A big one was the Relief Act, which aims to help Maryland residents and local businesses through the economic effects of the pandemic. What all is in that package?
Well, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we actually started coming into session saying we wanted to work in a bipartisan manner. And we started off great and actually passed the Relief Act that the governor initiated. Worked with the Democrats. We had a kumbaya time on the floor. Everybody was happy. And then we went into the more partisan issues. But that's really targeted relief to those individuals who have been hurt by COVID the most. Individuals, small businesses, those who hadn't received their unemployment benefits, they got $1,000. There was multiple things that they didn't have to pay the sales tax for a certain time. And then their unemployment benefits, they were not going to be taxed during the tax season. And then they had $300 million in targeted relief for like food banks and utility payment assistance and so forth. So it was very broad, but very targeted. And I believe it passed unanimously on our side.
Big priority for Democrats was police reform. Some of the bills passed repeal the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, expand public access to police discipline records, and limit when police can use no-knock warrants. What concerns do you have about this new policing legislation? We only have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, police reform was within our grasp, but we let the extremes take over and it became a partisan issue. We sent over 9 bills that we worked probably 60, 70 hours on, and I think 6 or 7 of them, we had unanimous support. It was coming together bipartisan and actually doing police reform, such things as better training. We supported that. De-escalation training, body cameras, more accountability and transparency, and the list goes on. But when it came back from the House, it became very partisan. There was the public shaming of police officers that they would post just allegations against them, and it could even be anonymous. So even though it was just an allegation, they would put it publicly, opposed to waiting to get it confirmed that that was true or not. And then, so we thought that was unfair. Undefined terms. What is excessive force? They picked a two terms that aren't defined in law, which is necessary and proportional. And what's going to happen, unfortunately, like we saw in Baltimore since 2015, the police are going to pull back because they can get a 10-year jail sentence for it if they get this wrong. So instead of engaging in a life and death situation, they're going to say, you know what, it's not worth going to jail. I'm just going to step back. And you know who hurts that? Not only the police, but the communities they're protecting. And I think that's really what you're going to see. We've already got people calling in even the day it passed saying, you know, I'm retiring. And I think you're going to have a harder time getting new recruits. And they're going to lower the bar to let more people in because they're going to need them. And again, that hurts the communities because you don't have as good of officers out there. And as far as a no-knock warrant, you know, they limit it basically to the daytime. So, you know, the potential criminals can be prepared. And then they have to wait 20 seconds. And if I waited 20 seconds on this interview, it would be such a long time before they can enter. And then they put the investigation of the a death of a person under a political office of the AG, who is an elected official, very political, instead of under the state prosecutor, which the Senate had done. So there was numerous areas where we agreed. We wanted to have bipartisan police reform. We believed in it. But it ended up becoming an anti-police group of bills, which was very frustrating to us and many in the Senate.
Well, there were 3 parts of that bill that were vetoed by Governor Hogan, but those vetoes were overridden. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Brian Simonaire is the minority leader in the Maryland State Senate. Mr. Minority Leader, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a privilege.
Joining us now is Boyd Rutherford, who is the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In an interview with Bruce DePoit of Maryland Matters this week, you announced that you would not run for governor of Maryland in 2022. Why not? What went into that decision?
Well, you know, last time I was on, I told you I was considering it. It was something that, you know, I've been considering for, you know, I guess, the last year. But if we go back 6 years ago, you know, the first time you all had me on the show, I had said at that time that I wasn't interested in the governor's, you know, position, that I was just trying to be the best lieutenant governor that I could be. And, you know, so, you know, as we, you know, got through the 18 election, I knew that there would be a lot of attention going my way. And, you know, I started to think more about it. I really considered it, leaning in both directions. But, you know, when I sat down with the family and talked to them about this and really did the soul searching and some prayer, it just really wasn't something for me. It wasn't in the heart. And I felt that, you know, the family dynamic is much more important than me running for governor and becoming the governor. So that was the decision, and I'm happy with it. And the family's happy with it.
Here's Tom Sherwin.
Governor, thank you very much, and best wishes with the decision. So what happens next for the Republican Party? We just spoke to Senator Simonaire from Anne Arundel County, and he said that he welcomed Commerce Secretary Kelly Schultz into the race. She's announced she'll run for governor, in part because you're not. But Senator Simon Eyre also says he'd like to see, you know, more than one candidate for the party to have a robust primary going into next year's elections. Do you know of other people who might run or telling you they'll run that you can say their names? Are there other people?
Well, there have been other people who've, you know, talked about it, but I don't know if they're, you know, how serious they are. And, you know, I had someone reach out to me, and I don't feel it's appropriate to say his name at this point because, and I just told you it's a he, that, you know, I don't think it's appropriate, you know, to give his name at this point, but I know Michael Steele had, you know, his name had floated, and I guess he in some article or interview had stated an interest. I don't know if Michael's going to do that or not. So, but I agree.
You and Michael went to the same high school in D.C. at the same time, didn't you, Archbishop Carroll?
Yes, we did. He was 2 years behind me. You know, 2 years behind me at Carroll. So, but I do remember a tall, lanky guy. He had hair then. I had hair then.
Are you confident the state party, again, I mentioned earlier, Virginia Republican Party's had a terrible time getting organized to get its candidates on the ballot for this year. Are you confident that the party is strong enough now under from what Governor Hogan has done in office for 2 years and you as lieutenant governor that you'll have strong candidates next year?
Yeah, I would expect we will. Yeah, I would expect that. Now, I'm not going to do anything in the primary, and I expect that there'll be, you know, at least another candidate, maybe more than one other candidate. I should say credible candidate, because you always have, you know, the Robin Thickers of the world who pop up, who's out there now. But there'll be at least, I would expect, another candidate. But I'm not going to participate in any in the primary.
What are you going to do? You're not. Of course, you've got to finish out the term all into next year. And you said you'll work as hard as you've been working. What are you going to do once you leave office? Do you have a specific plan?
Once I ride off into the sunset?
Yes, sir.
I am a lawyer by trade. So I'll probably go back and, you know, into practice. I've had some people saying to me they want to talk to me once my time is up. And so there are some other opportunities. I'll look at some nonprofit work to continue some of the efforts that I've been making with regard to the opioid crisis, mental health in particular, and some other areas to help some of the young people out there.
How about becoming chair of the Republican Party in Maryland?
I doubt that.
Well, we got a tweet from Carl who said, why didn't the Maryland Republican Party organize around a Lieutenant Governor Rutherford bid for governor? Had you run for governor, you would have been an early favorite in the Republican primary and perhaps in the race overall. Carl seems to think that you might be hurting the party's chances by not running. Was there ever an organized effort in the party to get you to run?
There were people talking to me, you know, about it, but, you know, it has to be a personal decision. And, you know, personal is more important than a party. That's just it.
How did your family feel about it?
They're happy I'm not running.
Okay.
I can't tell you that.
I'm afraid
They would have supported anything that I would have wanted to do. And, you know, the bottom line is I didn't want it bad enough. I never looked at myself as a politician. I was in a political and am in a political position. I have my opinions like anybody else, but I am not the career politician. A lot of these folks that are, you know, talking about running or who have announced that they're running, they've been in elected office for, you know, as long as
I've been. So you're not going to do it. And I'm afraid we're just about out of time. We're going to miss your YouTube series, Mundane But Wonderful, where you explain wonky subjects. Boyd Rutherford, thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
Okay, thank you. Well, we got some more mundane but meaningful topics to do.
Great. And thank you all for listening, and have a wonderful weekend. Any big plans, Tom Sherwood?
No, just enjoy the weekend.
You too, enjoy your weekend and stay safe. See you next week. I'm Kojo Nambi.